Hello, welcome to Democracy Talk, where people, politics, and power come together in Southwest Washington and beyond. I'm Donna Sinclair, and I'm here with my co-host, Deacon Lutnich.
We're talking with the folks doing the real work of democracy, elected leaders, union organizers, activists, and neighbors, people who show up, speak out, and help shape the world around us.
This show is about power, who has it, who needs it, and how we build a democracy that delivers for everyone. And it's about stories, the lived experiences, hard choices, and everyday actions that shape the world that we share.
We'll talk about leadership, accountability, and what it takes to govern through challenge and change.
This is Democracy Talk. Let's get into it. So we're starting today with a local leader who's been navigating all of this up close, Mayor Anne McInerney Ogle. She's served as Vancouver's mayor since 2018, a city councilor since 2014, and she's running for re-election this year as the city faces some big decisions.
From housing and growth to infrastructure and trust, we're talking about the kind of leadership it takes to steer a city through challenge and change. Mayor Anne, thanks for being here.
Thank you so very much.
We're so glad to have you. We'd like to first start with your story. So what brought you into public service? What has kept you motivated through the ups and downs of public life?
Well, public service started when I was very young as a Girl Scout. Well, probably as a Brownie. So Mother was my Girl Scout leader. We were always out in the public doing something, whether it was cooking food or serving or cleaning up or sewing pillowcases, I remember. But all through elementary school, junior high, high school, first of all, I knew I wanted to be a teacher. That meant that I was in the community. I was helping at Sunday school, at kindergarten, during summer scouting events, this, that, and everything else. And then as a teacher, 30 years in Lake Oswego, we were always in public service because, as anyone who's ever taught school knows, it's not an 8-to-5 job. You're there on the weekends, you're there after school, you're helping to coach, to encourage, to mentor, to do a little of everything. But when Terry and I married back in 1980 and moved into Vancouver, we had a neighborhood association. And that's when we started planting trees, meeting our neighbors, doing litter pickups, a number of different pieces of work. I became a neighborhood leader, knowing that that is where some of the decisions are being made, not just for my neighborhood, but for the city. And then from that into public service in the Planning Commission, volunteering for police, volunteering for fire corps, a number of different opportunities. And as a planning commissioner, I learned more about how the city decision-making policy was happening. So as I learned from that, it was an easy opportunity to say, what's the next step? How do we move on from there? What's motivated me through all of that? Problem solving. We're able to help individuals, whether it's your neighbor, whether it's building a park in our little neighborhood, planting a tree. All of that is very exciting when you give, when you volunteer. And a lot of public service is that opportunity to volunteer, to give a little bit more of yourself. And that warm, wonderful feeling you get when you're working together with someone else.
Well, I love that you said problem solving as a math teacher. Mm. That makes a lot of sense to me. And so now looking back at your work with the city, what kinds of accomplishments are you proudest of and what's been the hardest unexpectedly?
Well, yes. So getting through the pandemic was a huge piece, but I went to work every day. Now, it might have only been Amanda De La Pena and I at City Hall, the two of us, on the second floor. No one else was there. But the city is in the forever business, and when someone makes a call to City Hall, someone needs to pick up the phone. And that's what we did. But I also gave weekly videotapes. So we did CVTV, and we sent out a video every week about what we were hearing from the governor, what news would impact businesses and residents, and we shared that information with our community every week. Making it through the pandemic, both economically and oh my gosh, physically, trying to get everyone going in the same direction and helping them out was a huge success for all of us. But we still have small businesses that are suffering from that. And part of it is also the realization that our homeless issues became more prevalent. We realize what our issues were with homelessness. So that second success is the heart team. When we hired Jamie Spinelli and Tyler Chavers and their team, and they helped to educate us on how we could take care of the individual pieces of homelessness, that was joyful because we could see the progress. We could see that we were taking people out of tents, putting them in a shelter, working on their barriers, and helping them in that pathway to housing. Thank goodness Vancouver Housing Authority was part of that solution so that Andy Silver and his team could work with our team and we could get people moving up and out. So are we done with it? Oh, no. Are we solving bits and pieces of it? Yes. And different communities are coming to us and asking us, how did you do that? What are you doing? What makes it successful? Show us your numbers, show us your data, and help us understand how we can copy, we can duplicate, we can use your same skills in our community. So getting everyone on the same path was not easy, but getting the heart team moving and getting that success was such a personal joyfulness. We're not there. We're not done. But
you're saying the heart team. So why is it called the heart team and how does it work?
Okay. It's the resource team for housing, for homelessness, the homeless action and resource team. Jamie Spinelli has a team. The assistants, the team goes out every day to check on every single camp in the city of Vancouver. So you'll see Sheila and Tiffany and Cody, and you'll see Lon out there. Many of them have lived experience. They were in those situations. They understand those situations. So they will go out and they'll introduce themselves to you, and you need to respond, introduce yourself. And who are you? Why are you here? Let's do a housing assessment. Let's get you into the system. Now, if you're not going to play with our team, if you're not going to identify yourself, if you're not going to have that housing assessment, we're not going to allow you to stay here. You're not going to just come, plop down, and camp. You're going to work with us, and we'll work with you. We'll get you into that housing assessment to learn a little bit more about you and where you need to go, what resources we have to help you. Now, we may not have anything for you this week, but that team is going to come around and they're going to see you again. Oh, and if you move, we're going to find out where you went and reintroduce ourselves to you. Maybe you left our community, or maybe you're there the same place next week. We'll come back. How are you doing? You had a couple goals. Did you complete them? This is where we are with you. How are you doing on your goals? These are our goals. And the team continues to work with you on that path to housing. Now, as soon as Jamie has an opening at a safe stay, we have four of them, she might say, you're ready to come in to a safe stay, sign your behavior contract, all of these different requirements, and come and live in a community. And she'll move you into a safe stay. If you are not a good neighbor, that's probably not a good fit, but Jamie might have a better fit for you somewhere else. So it's her relationship with Council for the Homeless that can make that difference, because Council for the Homeless is the county. And they have other facilities other than our safe stay. That also means that Jamie and Tiffany and Sheila and all of them might see that you're living in an RV. That might have an opening at our safe park. and that might be a place for you, and we'll help you get your RV to a safe park. As you are with us, you have a case manager and you continue to work on your barriers. When you graduate, so to speak, and Andy has a place at Vancouver Housing Authority's multiple units, you get to move up into one of those units. And that opens up that safe stay for someone who's living in a tent to come in. Now, we are continuing to build shelter because we don't have enough. So the next piece of that is what we call the congregate shelter. It's called a bridge shelter. It's not a shelter under a bridge. It's just to bridge you from tent to a brick and mortar or a safe stay piece. So we, with the help of Michael Lynch, the philanthropist, found a piece of property on the east side of Van Mall, the old Nadenhoff gym area, bought it, bulldozed it. We are at 100% design. We have two buildings. One building for living, sleeping, etc. The other is the kitchen, and that's in a different building. So we're not putting the two of them together. Probably steel, engineered steel buildings. And we're going through the permitting system right now. It'll hold 120, 135 people. And that will be ready in 8 or 9 months. So again, to get you out of the tent into shelter. And I'll go back. If you're not ready to play with us, work with us, live with us, then we're not going to allow you to just hang around and camp. If you continue to do that, we're going to send you to community court. And if you don't show up at community court to answer for your charges, then we have a warrant for your arrest. I just delivered lasagna salad, and Bonnie from Blue Door's wonderful baguettes, all buttered and warmed, at community court for all of those individuals that showed up today to meet with their commissioner, the judge, if you would, to talk about why they are not working with us. So...
And is that productive?
Very successful. Yeah, okay. Very successful. Because Aaron Priest, the judge in this, works very well with them and gives them specific regulations and rules that they need to do. And they need to do community service and a number of different pieces and continue to come back, or that stays on their record. If they complete their work with her, their record is clean, but they also learn how to work with us and Jamie and the HEART team to move forward with their lives. And we've had lots of graduations, lots of success. We're very tickled with that.
Well, that's good to hear. I think Deacon has a question.
Yeah, I'm going to pivot a little bit, but Mayor Ann, your opponent has raised some concerns about transparency and integrity in city leadership. How do you respond to those allegations, and what does accountability look like to you as a mayor?
Well, let's go back to the transparency piece. Every decision that we make is always by law published. We have what we call a three-touch process. We have a workshop, and then the decision is a first reading, and then the final decision comes in a public hearing. And those are spaced out so that the community has the opportunity to look at our agenda, attend the workshop, come and learn along with the rest of us. Give us your written input, send it to us, tell us what you're thinking about a particular issue. And at each one of those steps, everyone has the opportunity to give us their testimony, some verbal, some in person, some you can just make a phone call, some you can type it in, send it to us, or bring us a piece of paper, handwritten or typed, whatever, and bring us your thoughts about a particular issue. So the transparency piece surprises me, because that's an old process for the 40 plus years that I've known public engagement. We've always known what the city council is working on. This idea that, oh, well, your email isn't on the website. Yeah, it is. So if you go to the council website and you have three little bars up there, you scroll over and you touch that one that says contact. What's your message? Who do you want to send it to? I get them. But, you know, the phone also works. And I had an 8-year-old write me a lovely letter, and it was delivered. So transparency is pretty easy.
No shortage of ways to see what the council is working on or get in touch with their mayor?
No,
I didn't think so. But. No.
The accountability and integrity. We are accountable for everything. Every decision that is made, it's recorded. So if you have any chance to look at the minutes of every single decision, you'll see how each of the councilors and the mayor vote on each issue. There should not be any surprises. You'll notice that as we go through every single thing, sometimes there's a roll call vote. I'll call all those in favor, oppose. It's all on CVTV. So if you can't attend a city council meeting, you can watch CVTV. It's on the website. You can download everything. You can watch us vote. Everything is pretty much right in front of it, and it's recorded, and you can go back 7 years and take all the information you want. So.
Like a giant fishbowl of city council access.
If you're that interested and you want to stay awake at 2 a.m, sure.
Terrific. You're listening to Democracy Talk, where we dig into what it takes to build the society that works for everyone. More with Mayor Ann McInerney Ogle after the break.
The Columbian in Southwest Washington continues to offer the most comprehensive and consistent coverage of our region and our people, despite the challenges faced by local newspapers nationwide. Valued donations to our community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation pays for local reporters to provide expanded and in-depth coverage of key local issues in print and online, including homelessness, transportation, and the environment. For the most thorough daily coverage, visit Columbian.com. Please consider donating or subscribing today.
Programming like this is made possible by support from High Five Cannabis, your local cannabis connection in Vancouver and Stevenson, Washington. High Five offers flower, concentrates, edibles, tinctures, topicals, and more. Whether you're new to cannabis or know what you need, their staff is available to assist. If you go to highfivecannabis.com, spelled H-I-G-H, the number 5, cannabis.com, you can learn about their specials like Munchy Monday, Senior Tuesdays, Waxy Wednesdays, and Loyalty Thursdays. Again, that's highfivecannabis.com.
Thank you to Georgie's Garage and Grill for making programming like this possible.
They offer a full bar and signature meals for breakfast, lunch, and dinner that is not the usual bar food. Their food will keep you coming back for more.
Dine in or take out.
Georgie's Garage and Grill is located downtown Vancouver at 606 Broadway Street.
More information can be found at georgiesgng.com.
You're listening to Democracy Talk. We're back with Mayor Ann McInerney Ogle to talk about the choices shaping the kind of society we build together. You know, that's actually, I think I get kind of excited by democracy, and it's hard work, and it takes work to engage in it, be part of it, but also to know what's happening. So that's part of what I'm hearing from what you're saying.
Thank you.
One of the other questions we had was about parking fees. Mm-hmm. So that's what's happening right now. Right. Can you tell me about that decision or tell us about that decision?
Sure. So we learned a lot of, well, City Council covers a number of different issues. What we were finding is that on the weekends, especially down at Farmers Market, we had a number of people who would bring in their trucks and trailers and park and take up parking and stay there all day. And parking never turned over. So we learned Farmers Market has over 100 different vendors and people coming and such. We needed to turn things over. We need the employees to park elsewhere and allow the patrons to have a place to park. And we were also finding that people would park in downtown and then be gone for 6 hours. They'd go for a walk here, there, or yonder. We need that to turn over. So we are trying this pilot project. As we looked at this, we said, all right, let's take an opportunity and do this in two phases. and charge 7 days a week with enforcement, not hiring a bunch of new staff, unfortunately, they will stagger their work. From Evergreen to the river, I-5 to the railroad tracks is phase one. All of the parking in there will be the same price that it is right now, but it will be charged on Saturday and Sunday, same hours. So if you want to come down in the evening, like a lot of people do, it's free parking. And not going to phase two just yet. Phase two was north of Evergreen. So we asked staff, check this out. Give us a quarterly report. How is the turnover happening? And what are the impacts that you're seeing, hearing? Do some surveying and get some answers for us. Before we go to phase two, who would be most impacted? And for Sunday, it would be some of those churches that have moved in there, including St. Paul. But the other piece was, what will you do with the fees? Some people think the fees go into the general fund and we're just making money off of it. No, actually it doesn't. Parking is what we call an enterprise fund. It has to stay within there. It has to get its own money, get the revenue, and spend the revenue, spend those expenses and everything. It has to stay within itself. So that means the new Kitty app, the new electronic, instead of the old heads with coins, although you can still use coins in the new electronic stations and such. But we've also talked for many years about the shuttle, and staff has been working with CTRAN for quite some time to talk about how do we do that shuttle. You also have LSW's ride, the little electric shuttle that LSW created. And that discussion needs to move forward. We need to have an opportunity to move people in a very tight space. So those funds could go to that shuttle and the operation of that shuttle. So again, we ask staff, go out, work on it, come back and talk to us in a quarterly manner. Let's not go too far. If this isn't working out, let's talk about it.
Okay, well, I was wondering about that. So thank you very much for explaining it in detail.
Yep.
You're facing re-election in a time when trust in government is shaky, Mayor Ann. What do you say to voters who are skeptical or disengaged?
This is the opportunity that they actually need to work harder than ever before. They need to stay engaged. I know it's not the big steps, but it's the little steps. So, for example, we have 71 neighborhood associations. All of them work on a number of different problems that are in their little community. It might be traffic. It might be the sound. Excuse me. It might be mufflers or sidewalks or stop signs or trees or parks or whatever. So I have always made it my point to be out, and I've touched base with all 71. But that's the opportunity where decisions are made. That's the opportunity where people can say, we need to work on this park and keeping it clean, or whatever their goal is. And how can the city partner with you to do that? That is the part that I enjoy, and I'm pretty good at it. It's also the part where we have 9 different business associations, whether they're large or small, this, that, and everything else. How do we keep them moving? What is the issue that you have right now? Is it that traffic impact fee over on Andreessen that you thought someone else would take care of and we need to work with you on that? Or is it you signed a lease before you realized you needed to put a vent through 2 stories? Though working in the community and helping solve the problems, going back to that topic, is what I've always enjoyed, and I'm pretty good at it. As we look at this time in our community, we're growing tremendously. 209,000 people, 3,000 people coming here, probably migrating for something green and a whole lot of water. How do we accommodate them? We can't put a wall up and say, no, you don't get to come in. What we need to do is allow you in and work with you so that you have you can live and thrive with you, your partner, your family, or yourself. So those are the things that we're working on.
Wonderful. Love to hear it.
Well, one of those things that has to do with crossing bridges has become quite an issue.
It has.
I'm wondering what you have to say about that. We've talked about this before, a really beautiful story, and now it's become a little more contentious. So what's happening from your perspective?
Little baby steps right now. A lot of the work is behind the scenes, behind the camera. Because we have a new administration that changed the staff in Washington, D.C., we have individuals who are not there when we were making decisions 2 and 3 years ago. So they're asking those questions. So we've had to take a time out, go back, bring them up to speed on why we are where we are in this project, and then help them move the project forward. We are so close to what they call a record of decision. That means all of the bells and whistles need to be all lined up, ready to go. And solutions need to be, how do you get off of a 120-foot bridge down to the ground if you're on a bike, in a wheelchair, or you're walking? That's a very real problem. And so those are some of the decisions that are being made right now. We know that the bridge probably will be side by side, as we refer to bacon on a plate, not stacked pancakes. The lift bridge, the vertical lift, does not solve our problem. We believe that the mitigation needed to make that happen is in place. But we still have so many people coming into our community. Even they are asking, what do you mean the bridge goes up and down? You're new to our community. You don't understand. $132 million of commodities goes across that bridge every day. And when the bridge stops, no one does any movement. So it's the education of the new, reminding the old, moving forward with the new designs and the issues. We're working on the transit piece. We're working on the tolling piece. But every time you have new policymakers, new reviewers coming in and sitting at the table, you have to go back, bring them up to speed, re-educate them, and then you start from that point forward. It's not easy.
Marianne? Let's address one other quick question in regard to the bridge, and hopefully you can just dispel a rumor really quick. Would you anticipate a fare of north of $20 to cross the new bridge, as we've maybe seen in some other places?
I haven't seen that in other places in the state of Washington or Oregon. I cannot imagine that happening. I don't make that decision. That decision is between the two states. And I can't imagine knowing those individuals who are making that decision allowing that either. The toll is to pay off the construction of the bridge. Now, each day that that bridge construction project is delayed, it's $1 million. It's going to take us longer to pay this off. We have tariffs right now on steel. So our old numbers are not good numbers moving forward. How long does it take to pay off a bridge? As long as it takes, and we'll have a toll on that bridge until it's done, and perhaps afterwards to maintain the paint and the garbage collection and painting out the graffiti and sweeping out the gravel and everything else. But I cannot imagine that amount. Maybe in 50, 60 years, because we're expecting this bridge to last over 100 years, but not in 2033 when the bridge opens.
Wonderful. Thank you for that.
You bet.
One final thing from me. I always like to ask candidates a kind of a silly question. It's basically, if I handed you this wonderful City of Vancouver magic wand, and if you were fortunate enough to be reelected, you could wave that magic wand one time and get one campaign promise. Without a doubt, committed, solved, funded, whatever that obstacle may be. Mm-hmm. What's the one thing you would use your magic wand on if reelected?
Mm-hmm. Deacon, let me rephrase your question just a little bit. You know, when you see the lottery is up there at $753 million, and what would you do with it? It's kind of that same thing. I would love to have our homeless problem taken care of. where individuals can come in, get the necessary mental health or alcohol, drug treatment, whatever kind of barrier they have, treatment for them. But I need our community to be safe, secure, and thrive. And whether they feel safe or they're living in tents or any of that, it's all one big package. I need people to be able to live safely and healthy. I need children to not couch surf. I need them in school so that they can learn to read and not have to worry about taking backpacks of food home. I think all of that kind of wraps up to a community that works with individuals to solve their housing and food insecurity, health. Oh my gosh, I would love to have a couple more local clinics. We just cut the ribbon on another clinic that is working with individuals, but they're on Medicaid. So that's going to be a huge issue. So my wand or my lottery when I win it would be for a safe, healthy community that has the shelter and food that they need to thrive.
I love it. I got to be honest with you. There was a big part of me that was hoping you would say IBR, but totally understand your answer as a laborer.
I'm a cheerleader, but that's someone else's problem. We'll just work on it.
Wonderful.
Well, it's time for us to wrap up, and I heard about democracy at every level just now. So thank you so much for joining us today.
This was fun. Thank you so much.
Stay with us. This is Democracy Talk, where we're asking what it takes to build a fairer, more inclusive society. More after the break. And if you want to reach Mayor Ann McInerney Ogle about her campaign, go to VoteAnne, that's ANNE.com, VoteAnne.com.
Discover Underbar, a speakeasy-themed cocktail lounge located in downtown Vancouver. An LGBTQ-friendly and gay-owned space, it's a go-to destination for weekly events such as comedy, trivia, bingo, and open mic nights. Local artists are featured every first Friday of the month, and every fourth Sunday is Underbar's Underground Drag Brunch Show, 2 to 4 p.m. More information can be found at underbarvancouver.com. For over 20 years, Vancouver Family Magazine has been covering local news, recreation, travel, education, parenting, personalities, and more. We connect your family to people, places, ideas, organizations, helpful resources, and local stories. Pick up your copy every month at over 300 locations all over Clark County or read online at vancouverfamilymagazine.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X for even more local news and family fun at Vancouver Family.
If you're looking for pizza in East Vancouver, consider visiting Giuliano's Pizzeria in the Cascade Park Fisher's Landing neighborhood. For 37 years, Giuliano's has been a choice for Clark County residents. Giuliano's has a casual classic rock atmosphere, open 7 days a week, and they provide table service allowing you to relax and enjoy your meal with family and friends. If you have a large crowd to feed, Giuliano's can deliver six or more extra large pizzas to your office or event. More information can be found at giulianospizza.com.
Welcome back to Democracy Talk, where people, politics, and power come together in Southwest Washington and beyond. I'm Donna Sinclair, here with my co-host, Deacon Letnich, and we have another very special guest with us today. We have Dr. Senator Adrian Cortez, who was recently elected from the 18th Legislative District, and he has quite a resume, former battleground mayor, former planning commissioner, and city councilor, and he's actually known for his fiscal conscientiousness, which I think is pretty great. So welcome, Adrian.
Well, thank you. Thank you both for having me. This is a great special treat to be on this show, my first time on this show, and so thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, this is our first show, and we're pretty excited about having you here today.
Yeah, it's really nice to kick it off, and I think a lot of people will be surprised to learn that Adrian actually holds a Guinness World Record for most cocktail olives eaten in a minute.
Oh. I do?
Oh, no,
I didn't even know that.
Different Adrian, my mistake.
Oh, okay.
No, but what we do have is a newly elected Washington State Senator, your first term in office. And I think the easy question, and I'll throw it out straight away, is what do you think you're most proud of after your first session in Olympia?
Well, certainly my first session in Olympia was had a lot of successes, a lot of challenges. It was very fulfilling, very rewarding. But it, there was a lot of work involved. I'll put it to you that way. I constantly got approached by people that have been up there for quite some time, other legislators, and they said that this has been a historic session, something they hadn't seen in, you know, 20, 30 years. And at first I thought it was a lot of hyperbole and rhetoric, but the more and more session went on, I thought, you know, I think there's a little something to that. That being said, I'm proud that I was able to prime sponsor 15 bills during session. And of those 15 bills, five of them actually made it to the governor's desk and got signed into law. Bills ranging from increasing access for special education students, going from age 21 to 22, to expanding the childhood court for children to be able to access the childhood court, specialty license plates, also to some of the other items that got signed into law was my ADO bill. In terms of every region in the state has ADOs. In our region, our ADO is the Columbia River Economic Development Council, and so we provided some more support for them to be able to work and engage in their primary mandate, which is to work with public and private entities to engage in economic development. So those are just a few of the examples of the bills I worked on. And it was just so special to be up there and be able to meet with constituents and, you know, attend committee meetings. I am on the Transportation Committee, the Early Learning and K-12 Education Committee, and then the Finance and Business and Trade Committee. Again, just had a really good time engaging with constituents and working for the people.
Well, you said that it was a historic session and you weren't so sure about it at first, but then you were convinced. What convinced you?
Just the sheer volume of work that was there. Look, we were faced with a monumental task. We were faced with a budget deficit that was in the neighborhood of $16 billion, and that's a billion with a B. We made about $7 to $8 billion in cuts. Unfortunately, while it's always good to, trim areas that you could have some efficiencies created, but in other areas, we had to trim essential services, providing early childhood care. That was really terrible to have to do that, but we had to trim some items. And then I didn't necessarily agree with this in terms of some of my other colleagues, but there was some tax increases that were instituted. I voted no because I feel there was a better way to do it and not increase taxes that are primarily on the backs of working families. One of the bills I did introduce to lower the sales tax rate from 6.5% to 6%, and that's the state's portion, that would roughly return back to working families in $1.3 billion per year, because I feel that it's time to stop financing budget shortfalls on the backs of working families. It's time for those that have been rewarded the most to pay their fair share, right? I think wealth should be celebrated, but when you have that success, it's also your responsibility to pay your fair share for the rest of society.
I couldn't agree more, honestly, and I'm surprised that we didn't see a little more towards a wealth tax this session. Adrian, you had the opportunity to serve as the mayor of the city of Battleground for quite some time, and I'm curious how that experience was able to help ease you into your role as a senator in the state of Washington in your first session.
As mayor, especially I was mayor during COVID, have to be able to reach across the lines. You have to be able to collaborate with individuals that may have a very, very different perspective than you, and work with so many different stakeholders to really move your city forward. We went into COVID, the council passed an emergency resolution. They granted the mayor extraordinary authority to act on behalf of the city. And so I took that responsibility very seriously in being able to, you know, help businesses reopen or modify their openings, working with, you know, state and local government agencies on providing some form of relief for constituents. And so, yeah, it's just a lot of moving parts. Same thing being in the Senate, a lot bigger group of people that you have to work with, a lot bigger issues because there's statewide issues, not just the city. So,
how much of a challenge was that for you with that many different personalities in the room and having to work with so many different members? How do you get through it? What was the biggest part of the learning curve as far as trying to get your message to a room of new people?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, the first couple of weeks, there was a lot of sitting and listening because there's a lot of personalities, a lot of experience in the room. And so you're listening, understanding kind of the dynamics of the caucus. And then when you're on the Senate floor, understanding the dynamics of the other side of the aisle and the personalities and what they bring. And so as session went on, I started to feel more and more confident in adding my voice to the different discussions. But every day was exciting, but a challenge because there were some days I had 15 to 18 meetings every 15 minutes with different constituency groups. So it could have been an individual, could have been a lobbyist, it could have been, you know, whomever, and they were just going back to back to back. And then I would also have two different standing committee meetings I'd have to attend to. And then once the day was over, the day was not really over because then you'd have to head off to a social with one of the lobbyists that wants to kind of pick your ear. So the days were very long, but again, like I said, very rewarding.
Would you say that there was one or a couple, I don't know, who would you say helped ease you into that process? Who was your mentor for your first go?
I don't think I can just point to just one individual that was my mentor. I had several of them. Obviously, Senator Annette Cleveland was very helpful in opening some doors and giving me some good perspective. I got a room up there because the days are long. And so I wasn't always able to come back home and go to sleep in my own bed. So I had a room. And so one of my roommates was Senator Valdez. And so I was able to, get his perspective on a lot of different things. Senator Ramos, former Senator Ramos, was really, really good in terms of being reliable to turn to and ask questions with. And I was very, very saddened that towards the end of the session that he suddenly passed away. And so that really impacted me and everybody within our caucus.
One of the questions that I had was about your colleagues in the House. So you're a Democrat and you're, the rest of your delegation are Republicans. Were you able to work with those folks at all?
So surprisingly enough, I was able to work with some House members and on both sides of the aisles too. My peers, State Representative Stephanie McClintock and State Representative John Lay, they weren't very active when it comes to legislation. State Representative McClintock only passed one bill that actually got to the governor's desk, and State Representative John Lay was not successful in passing any bills. I was not invited to any town halls, so we did not do any town halls together. And it's not that I didn't want to do them, as I wasn't invited. I communicated with my constituents and did that individually, and that was just fine. But when it comes to State Rep John Lay, I have not hid from the fact that I feel that his election was illegitimate. For those that don't know, he got elected to the state house, but then shortly thereafter he pled guilty to two counts of voter fraud, and has to do 1 year of probation because of that. And so, in my opinion, his election is not legitimate, and so it's hard to do business up with somebody that you know that engaged in voter fraud, and that's how they got that position.
Well, and to be clear, that voter fraud is that he did not live in the 18th LD. And I, as someone who lives in Washougal, would argue that he still does not. You know, I just want to point out here, and I think this is actually going to be a great time for you to ask your bridge question, because if you hear John Lee, you probably hear bridge. But I think it's a really good time to point out how complicated and challenging the work of democracy can be. All of those meetings going up into a place like that, and then having colleagues who, unfortunately, I think it's really unfortunate they wouldn't get together with you, because I've seen Democrats and Republicans hold town halls before. Mm-hmm. So, but I think you have a question, a pretty important one.
I do. Thank you. I've heard Stephanie and John both complain that they can't pass anything because the Dems are just so mean. Do you feel like that's truly the case, or do you feel like it's maybe a lack of effort? But that's a feeling question, and so I didn't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah. So I can actually give a response on that. If you look at Stephanie McClintock's record, she didn't put forth a lot of bills. I think there was only maybe three that she put forward, and one of those actually made it through. Look, that's the reality of being up in Olympia. Is not every bill that you put forward in prime sponsor, is it going to make it to the governor's desk? There is so much work. You know, once you introduce a bill, it has to go to the committee, has to get a hearing. And that, I mean, it could die right there. It may not get a hearing depending on the chair. But if it gets a hearing, and if it gets, and if you're able to negotiate with your colleagues on it, going and getting exact out of committee, then it moves on to either ways and means, if it has a financial attachment to it, or it moves to rules. And then you have to have somebody on one of those committees to pull your bill so it makes it to the floor for a vote. And then if you're fortunate to make it that far, you have to get a majority of colleagues, whether it be, you know, your own caucus or a combination of your caucus and the other side of the aisle, vote for it and pass it. And then once that happens, you got to do the thing all over again on the other side, whether that's the House or the Senate. And so, yeah, it's tremendously difficult, but it's not impossible to get bills to pass. So for them to say, or for anybody to say that, hey, one particular party is not allowing our bills to pass. Well, look, I bet it's a bit of sour grapes, because that's just how things work up in Olympia. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. So,
another one of the really hot button issues is that giant double-headed green monster over the water just south of us here. I know a lot of people, a lot of commuters, a lot of tradespeople are really looking into how that interstate bridge replacement's moving forward. What kind of information or insight can you give us to that process, and maybe how you were involved in the Senate this year?
Right. So again, we had just talked about John Lay in one of the many, many things that separates him from myself. He spent an extraordinary large amount of time up in Olympia when he was on one of his committees, trying to do everything he could to kill the bridge and to derail the process. He was not successful at all whatsoever. But I will say that we did, in a bipartisan fashion, put forth a bill that allowed the state to bond against the tolls, right? And myself, Senator Cleveland, Senator Harris, one other Republican senator, prime sponsored or co-sponsored that bill together. It passed both the Senate and the House, and ultimately made it to the governor's desk to be signed into law. So we're actually having the Ogden dinner tonight, the Democratic dinner tonight. I'm going to announce during my speech, but because of that and a few other issues that we were able to resolve, I'm proud to say that late springtime, we will be breaking ground on the I-5 bridge, which is amazing. I'm so proud of that. There are some technical issues that'll happen after that, as far as, you know, what type of mass transit utilizes the bridge and those kind of details that still need to be kind of ironed and fleshed out. But in terms of the I-5 bridge, we will be breaking ground on that late spring of 26. And that's going to be a great day.
That is tremendous news and a great day, to say the least. So thankfully, this will probably air after the Ogden dinner, so your secret's still safe. Okay. But what great news, and thanks for sharing that with us here.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like we have breaking news, but it's not really quite going to break.
I know. We need like a little telegraph
yes, thing. Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, thank you for so much for sharing that with us. We only have a few minutes left, and so I have a couple of questions. One of them is, you know, we're Facebook friends, and so you shared a pretty poignant post. Would you mind telling us about it and why you shared that post about your passport?
Yes. So I shared on Facebook, and it actually took a lot for me to actually make that post. A lot of reflection on, you know, number one, should I post it and should I put that out there? And what I'm referring to is the post that has to deal with, you know, I never thought in my lifetime that I would have to ensure that every time I got my car keys and walked out my front door, that I would also have to make sure that I had my passport to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen. Unfortunately, that's the day and age that we live in. You know, there's reports out there that, you know, a federal U.S. marshal in Arizona was, you know, violently arrested because, you know, quote, they thought that he looked like the person that they were going after. When I mean they, I mean the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Bureau. And so they eventually let him go. But I mean, it's because he had, you know, I'll say it right here. He had brown skin. And he was Hispanic. And so, you know, and that is one of so many stories of U.S. citizens. These are full-blown U.S. citizens that are being, you know, targeted by ICE and arrested because they assume that they are somebody else and they're being wrapped up in this very chaotic, very... you know, unintelligent way of immigration. And so I want to do what I can to protect myself. And so I'm always walking around with my passport. Look, you know, a little bit about, I'll share a little bit about my family, my family's history. My grandmother, you know, she came to the United States roughly about 60 years ago. And she did so with her, at the time, with my mother, her daughter, as well as my two uncles. And they were very young when they came to the United States. And she did that out of tragedy and hope. And what I mean by tragedy and hope, when she was living in Mexico, her and her husband owned a construction company. And one day, it was payroll day, and my grandfather was murdered for his payroll checks that he had. And the way my grandmother tells it, you know, told it to me, was that the law enforcement brought his lifeless body into her kitchen table and set him on the table. And so she, you know, had that trauma of seeing that. And so what she did is she did the only thing she knew how to do is she wanted a better life for herself and her children. And so she applied for a permanent resident card in the United States. And for her and her children, she moved to Tijuana, lived there for close to a year until it got approved. Once it was approved, then she moved over to the United States in Southern California. And the first thing she did is she got a full-time job working at an electronics assembly plant. And she did that until she was retired. She cleaned houses on the weekend for extra income for her and her children. And then she enrolled in a community college to learn how to speak English. And so, and look, she wasn't wealthy. She wasn't highly educated. But she raised her kids the best she could, and they were productive members of society. And I firmly believe that had that situation happened today, she would be deported along with her children, and I wouldn't be here as the you know, a first generation student to graduate college. And so what's happening now, while we have many issues in society, immigration being one of them, that do need to be addressed, and there are problems with them that have been going on for many, many years. But what this federal administration is doing is chaotic. It's tearing apart families. It's not applying good moral principles in how it treats people. And so, I hope that it stops. I hope that we can get some common sense into what's going on the federal level. But it certainly doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, we don't have much time left, but I'm just going to say that I'd like to make one comment about democracy, and I'd love to hear one from each of you. And mine is that it is people like you, Adrian, that make America great, right? You have a doctorate, you teach special education, you are a member of your community who has just given back all the time. And so that makes me excited about democracy. Thanks. Deacon, do you have something to say?
Gosh, you really put me on the spot there. No.
Okay.
Democracy to me, I agree completely with your definition of democracy, but democracy is also in how you work with others that you don't necessarily agree with, right? And unfortunately, in this day and age, democracy has been shoved aside. And it's about brute force. It's about diminishing those that don't agree with you, diminishing their voice. It's about diminishing the institutions that uphold our democracy, whether that be the courts, whether that be state legislatures. And so, democracy requires a lot of different institutions, a lot of different people with different thoughts and different ideas to be able to thrive. And when you stamp that out, it turns into something quite the opposite. And that's where we get, quite evil things that happen. I'll just leave it at that. It's my hope that we don't continue down that path, but I am very, very, very fearful that we are marching in that direction.
Well, thanks for joining us on Democracy Talk, where we hear from people about the real work of democracy. So until next time, stay engaged, stay curious, and keep this conversation going.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.